Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Parent. An Australian lawyer has compiled witness statements that detail the horror of the offshore detention camps. Longtime human rights activist Julian Burnside QC has frequently represented people wanting to have the Australian camps on Manus and Nauru Islands shut down. Don Wiseman spoke to him about the witness statements and began by asking about comments from a doctor who'd been on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea, who described it as similar to concentration camps.
Bloke came to a meeting in my chambers in the first half of last year. I had not met him. He's a person who spent his professional life in the prison system in Australia, including in maximum security. And there were a few other sort of health workers in the meeting and also a senior Labor politician. And the doctor said that and the other things that are in that statement, but he also said that within a few weeks of working inside the camp at Manus, he had formed a view the conditions in which they're held and the way they're treated was 100 times worse than anything he's experienced in the Australian prison system, even including maximum security. And that's a fairly shocking thing when you think about it.
Yes, he said the camp appeared to be calculated to break the spirit of the detainees, encourage them to go home.
That was the view he had formed by the end of his time there. And incidentally, one of the other people who attended that meeting was a former detainee who had abandoned his claim for protection and had returned to Iran and attended the meeting by Skype. And he clearly agreed because he abandoned his claim for protection and was hiding in the back blocks of Iran. But I was going on to say that when the meeting broke up, the parliamentarian stayed on. And this is someone I've known for quite a while and whose thinking on human rights issues I think is fairly sound. And he expressed real shock at the things that he'd heard and said that he hadn't known about those things before. And then without missing a beat, he said, mind you, it would be political suicide for us to take a soft line on boats. Now, in that single sentence, I think you capture the problem in Australia with dealing with boat people. You know, both major parties do it largely for political purposes to advance their political interests. And it seems they don't care just how shockingly they behave.
Yes, although there would appear to be in that latest poll perhaps more people becoming concerned about these camps than before.
It's very hard to know. I mean, I hope that's true, but since about 2002, if anything, I would say the views that I stand for have been losing ground.
Just looking at some of these other witness statements, one came from a detainee talking about what he had seen of people who had witnessed the beating of Retsa Bharati resulted in his murder. Yeah. And they made witness statements, and then they were bound up and tortured and forced, or attempts were made to force them to retract their statements.
And this was being done by Wilson security guards.
Yeah. And if we could move on to some of the other people, another former employee at Manus Island, we've heard a lot about self-harm at the camps. This staff person says that self-harm was just something that was ignored. It was almost expected.
Yes, and that is entirely consistent with everything I've learned about the detention system onshore and offshore over the last 14 years. One which is not included there because it is a matter, it was in onshore detention, a bloke who had fled Saddam Hussein's Iraq. The department's notes of interviews with him show that within a couple of weeks of his arrival in Australia, they recognised that he had been tortured in Abu Ghraib prison and that the form of torture that most terrified him was being locked in a small cell, because in Abu Ghraib prison he'd been locked in a small cell and randomly electrocuted through water on the floor. So he's terrified of being locked in a small cell. After about 18 months, he's pretty much given up on everything and he starts to harm himself by cutting. And so, you know, if he can find anything sharp, he'll cut himself. When he cuts himself, he is given Panadol, which is the universal cure in detention, and solitary confinement in a small cell. Doesn't help. So when he gets out, he's worse and he cuts himself again. He's given more Panadol, solitary confinement in a small cell, and so on. And this went on for 5 years. And when eventually the department was persuaded to have him admitted to a psychiatric hospital for assessment, they performed a physical and mental examination on him. This is a man in his late 20s, early 30s, the mental assessment was that he's so damaged he'll probably never be able to hold down a job of any sort. The physical assessment showed he had 10 metres of scarring on his body from self-harming in detention. That sort of captures the whole thing when you think about it.
Yes. Another statement from a medical doctor who was on Christmas Island and talking about the horrific state that asylum seekers would arrive in and how they were treated, and talks specifically about the injections given to women because the medical records went missing and many were given inappropriate injections, including 5 pregnant women, 4 of whom had miscarriages.
It's just terrible. We really do treat them as if they're not actually human beings, and it's largely driven by politicians' desire to gain votes.
Villages in a remote area of Fiji still need aid after being struck by Cyclone Wilson nearly 2 months ago. The New Zealand Defence Force has been among those delivering supplies around the country for the past 6 weeks. Sally Rown took to the air with them on one of their last aid drops.
Packs of tents donated by China are being loaded onto one of the Air Force's NH-90 helicopters. Major Logan Vaughan is among New Zealand, Fijian and Australian forces at one of the aid hubs near Suva.
Initially, a lot of the aid that we took in from New Zealand and from Australia and the places nearby. Lately, countries like China and other countries have been giving a lot of aid also, and we're just getting that out there as sort of the second or third rotation of aid out to these outlying places.
The international aid effort is being coordinated by Fiji with help from UN agencies and other aid groups. Flight Lieutenant Peter Familton is one of the New Zealand pilots, making up to 6 supply drops a day around Fiji.
As far as I know, I think we've taken some water engineers into one of the villages, and they went around and assessed the wells and the water supplies for any damages and contamination. And then following that, it was food and tent supplies, which is what we're continuing today.
From the air, the houses in Nawaisomo are small dots in the cyclone-swept hill country well north of the capital, Suva. This village is normally only reachable by riverboat, but the chief's boat was washed away in the storm, and now the people are even more isolated. The helicopter swoops down and the villagers rush in to form a chain and help unload. The children clutch Bibles, men are in ties and girls in special dresses. They've just been to church when the New Zealanders drop in. The chief, Ratu Waisea Drakusiwale, is there to meet us.
This is the 12th of the...
12th?
Yeah, 12th. Yeah.
Oh, so everybody's used to helicopters now?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very exciting to all the children new to see the helicopter.
Ratu Waisea says a dozen houses were damaged in Winston, but rebuilding has started. And he started on a new boat. But he's worried because staple root crops have been ruined.
Yeah, all the cassava planted there, now all damaged. See? Right over there. Yeah, now no more cassava there. I plant some vegetable beside my kitchen, down there, but not enough. All the villagers have come and collected from there.
Ratu Waisea says one little girl's already had to go to hospital. He suspects because of lack of food. He takes me aside before we depart.
So you're going to tell them? Yeah, if you can, please.
How much more food do you need?
84 houses.
So how many people?
About 300.
Food for 300 people. Do you urgently need the food?
Yeah, mostly we need the food.
As we leave, I promise him I'll let the disaster authorities know. The New Zealand Defence Force is planning to complete its Fiji aid mission at the end of the week. In Fiji, Sally Round.
Papua New Guinea's anti-fraud and corruption unit has been homing in on the country's prime minister in its battle to investigate high-level corruption. A Supreme Court judge and a lawyer representing the Secretary of the Treasury, along with Peter O'Neill, were arrested yesterday in Port Moresby. It is the latest in a development in a corruption scandal that has threatened the prime minister since 2014. Alex Peraltis spoke to the unit's chief superintendent, Matthew Derimar, who says that Judge Bernard Sokora received payment from a lawyer linked to the Paul Paprikas lawyers at the time he was presiding over the case.
He received a payment of 100,000 kina from a company that is associated or connected to Paul Paprikas lawyers.
And this being the firm that that has alleged
the
to
have... center of this payment of legal bills.
From the government to the order of about 30 million US dollars.
Yes.
And we had this decision last week, basically, that the Supreme Court decided that the path to arresting the Prime Minister is open, that the stay order is not there. But at the same time, there's a secondary, I suppose, procedural matter regarding legal fees, which, again, prevents the Prime Minister from being arrested until that is settled. Is that the case?
Yeah. There's one more case, and that case prevents us from arresting the Prime Minister. The judge has given them the leave to appeal the decision made by the one-man Supreme Court. So it will depend when that appeal will be heard and determined. Then we can progress with the Prime Minister's case.
And you're confident on behalf of the police that you do have substantial evidence proving that the Prime Minister has been involved since 2014 or before, when the original arrest warrant was issued in this case involving Paul Paprikas lawyers?
Yeah, well, we have evidence. We wouldn't have just got the warrant for the sake of getting a warrant.
And the other arrest, of course, yesterday was the lawyer, Tiffany Twivey, who represents the Prime Minister, but she was arrested, I believe, in relation to her client, the Secretary of Treasury. Could you explain to me what's been alleged there?
Yeah, well, she took steps to prevent the arrest against the Secretary of Treasury, Mr. Dadi Vere. And since last year, it's almost 1 year now, she has not prosecuted the matter, and the case has been kept adjourning without no end to all the adjournments. So that is seen as an attempt to pervert the course of justice.
In a sense, with all ups and downs of this case in the last 2-3 years, we've seen people come in and out of the police. We've seen Jeffrey Vuckey go behind bars.
Yes.
You yourself really have been a bit of a survivor here. You've been assaulted yourself by someone in relation to the case. What sort of fears do you still harbour for your own well-being as this case gets closer and closer to the Prime Minister?
Concern for the welfare, and not myself only, but all the detectives that I work with. But we are trusting God to take care of us and protect us, because we are standing up for what is right.
Reformed Vanuatu land laws are finally being implemented after a year of delays. The Minister of Lands, Ralph Rangenvau, has handed over the first negotiator certificate to be issued for lease applications for customary land. A certificate gives a green light for the potential lease to negotiate with customary landowners on the terms of a lease agreement. He told Johnny Blades the certificates are approved by the Land Management Planning Committee, which includes relevant national and local government agencies.
They all look at the application, and if they agree that the lease is appropriate according to planning guidelines and according to priorities of the government in a particular location the land is being applied for, they sign off on it, and then it goes to the customary land management office, which then determines who is the customary owner of the land, or the custom owners of the land, or if the land's in dispute, who the disputing parties are. And then they ask them, are they interested in such a lease on their land? Are they interested in talking to the potential lessee about doing a lease? And if they do agree, and then the negotiation certificate is issued, which gives them a year to finalise their lease agreement.
The government says it's got the aim of having 15 negotiation certificates issued within the first 100 days. I mean, is that likely? These are quite complex processes, aren't they?
Well, we developed the aim of 15 after consultation with the Custom Land Management Office, and they came up with that figure. So they feel confident that they can get 15 done, which are already in process.
It's all about making sure disputes over land are sorted out before leases are issued and things like that.
Yes, there's two basic principles to the new land laws, which we're now starting to see the certificates being issued. The first one is that the government as a whole has to agree on a lease, and it's not only the minister, which was in the previous case. We just had a Supreme Court ruling just come through a couple of weeks ago where the government is liable for 45 million vati because the minister signed an improper lease unlawfully. So it stops all that kind of stuff. It stops all the backhand, underhand dealings, going around the back and visiting the minister, it basically removes the power of the minister. It has to go through this process. So that's one side. The other side is to do with the identification of the customary owners. And the law is designed to meet the standard of free, prior, informed consent of the customary owners of the land. And so the law requires explanation to the customary owners in the place they live about what the lease is for, that they have time to discuss, and then all of them have to come back and say, yes, we agree to it.
Was this part of the land reforms that you'd put in place sort of before the removal of the Ngatiman government, and then, of course, Paul Tarluk had a stint again in the role?
Yes. These are actually the first negotiation certificates issued for customary land since the laws were changed. So the process is a lot more stringent. These could have happened a lot earlier, but we had to suspend the whole implementation of the land laws after Cyclone Pam at the beginning of last year. So for a whole 6 months, we suspended the implementation of the new laws to focus on relief to the population. And then midway through last year, the former Minister of Lands, Paul Tarluk, came in and announced that he was going to repeal all the laws. And so he stopped the implementation for another 6 months until the election. And then now that we're back in, we are now rolling it out and it's starting to happen as per the intention.
Around 40 Pacific fisheries ministries and officials are in New Zealand to learn about the country's approach to fisheries management. Tuna is a key resource for most Pacific nations, and a commitment was made in New Zealand at last year's Pacific Islands Forum to help improve sustainability. Don Wiseman reports.
At the Pacific Leaders Summit last year, New Zealand Prime Minister John Key put $50 million New Zealand dollars on the table towards the forum's roadmap to fishing sustainability.
That $50 million will be used in areas like transitioning to a quota management system away from a daily catch, and that requires far more sophisticated ministries, it requires equipment, it requires scientific research. We think actually we'll end up spending more than that.
Mr. Key was championing New Zealand's quota management system over the Vessel Day Scheme, or VDS, operated mostly by the eight countries making up the parties to the Nauru Agreement. The PNA sells days to distant water nations and has turned this into a highly lucrative source of income from the purse seiners that fished for skipjack in their respective EEZs. But there's no talk now of wanting the VDS to go. James Movick heads the Forum Fisheries Agency. He says the roadmap is not about shoehorning everyone into the same system.
I don't think that there is a requirement that they move away from it. Rather, an encouragement that we look at to improve upon the management processes that are agreed by the parties to those three sub-regional fisheries arrangements, with a view to maximising the benefits we get from both conservation and economic development.
The head of the PNA, Dr. Transform Angaro, says he welcomes this apparent change of heart.
It's nice to see that there's a reversal in what people are saying, but that's not what was coming out last year. What was coming out was they were saying that it's going to be catch. We're moving away and moving towards catch. But I think that has to be explained properly. And it's good to see that there's a reversal in the way in which it's been characterized now.
New Zealand's Pacific Economic Development Ambassador, Shane Jones, said this week he welcomes the financial success the PNA has had, says New Zealand is supportive of that. But he says there are other fisheries challenges.
Not the least of which is the longline fishery, where the level of regulation is woeful, and unfortunately the level of high seas fishing threatens to ruin the sustainability of the longline fishery. And a lot of what we're doing this week is actually focusing on those problems.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister of the Cook Islands, Henry Puna, who's also that country's fisheries minister, is singing the praises of the New Zealand catch-based system. He says it's one of the best in the world.
We all share a common objective of making sure that fisheries in the Pacific is sustainable well into the future, and we believe that the quota management system will deliver that for us.
The week-long fisheries study tour will involve some time in Nelson, including a visit to the maritime training school there.
Saying on this subject, the fishery ministries from a number of Pacific countries gathered in New Zealand, as we mentioned, to discuss that issue. New Zealand offered the region $34 million last year to support the development of a catch-based system. The Director General of the Foreign Fisheries Agency, James Movek, says it's about shoehorning everyone into the same system. He spoke to Don Wiseman.
What the roadmap had said was that, generally speaking, where we can see benefit to moving to a catch-based system, we might choose to do so or seek to do so over a 10-year period. Given that there are some theoretical conservation as well as economic advantages that might accrue to those. But it really then has to be applied in the context of each of the three fisheries specifically. Now, the P&A, the Persane skipjack fishery, is certainly more advanced than the P&A vessel day scheme. To the extent that it meets the needs of those parties for conservation and economic development, then I don't think that there is a requirement that they move away from it. Rather, an encouragement that we look at to improve upon the management processes that are agreed by the parties to those three sub-regional fisheries arrangements, with a view to maximizing the benefits we get from both conservation and economic development. Not shoehorning everybody into one single system, and that's absolutely not the intention at all.
The FFA, given that members of the P&A are also members of the FFA, you're happy with their fishery to stay with the VDS system?
Well, they've got to make the decision. The members of the vessel day scheme, the Palau arrangement, they are the ones who need to make those decisions for that fishery. It's not the FFA's decision or anybody else's. The parties to each management arrangement need to make those, and they are the ones authorized to make it. We will continue to support them in whatever they do. In terms of looking at possible improvements, yes, we can have a role in the conversations around that. But at the end of the day, each of the contracting parties to each arrangement must be the ones that make the decisions with regard to their rights.
The reason I ask is that the Director General of the P&A, Transform Angaro, has been very critical of this idea to go towards a catch-based system. He says it would be far too difficult to apply in the Pacific, and that through VDS, the members of the P&A have seen a dramatic increase in their incomes from fisheries.
No, he's absolutely correct in that they have seen a dramatic increase. And there are a whole range of complexities that have to be considered, you know, moving the management arrangements under the vessel day scheme into any other arrangement. So, yes, I think he's quite right to say that one has to address all those complexities. And as I've said earlier, you know, at the end of the day, after analysis is done of ways in which there might be different forms of management arrangements, it may be very likely that at the end of the day we'll say the current arrangements we have in place are the most practical and cost-efficient at the present time. That's a conclusion that all of the three management arrangements will be able to make, if that's how it appears after real close objective analysis.
Tourism officials in Tonga say the kingdom's domestic air service needs to improve significantly if it is to take a full advantage of an increase of international tourism. This month, Fiji Airways launched direct service between Nara and Vana, and Air New Zealand 777 touched down for the first time, increasing passenger capacity to 33% and cargo up by 40%. Tomofa Pasa told Koreri Vanuatu, "An expected increase in arrivals is great, but the islands won't reach their full potential unless domestic services are improved."
I think it's a great opportunity for the whole kingdom, especially with the introduction of the new service into Vavao. And I think this new service for Vavao has been long overdue. It should have been done 8 years ago, but due to various reasons from previous government, has pushed this progress and been delayed. The Air New Zealand 777-200 coming into Tuamotu, it gives great opportunities to have more seats available for a cheaper price. The only major problem we have now that our domestic flight is not well prepared to handle the inter-island movement between Vava'o and Nuku'alofa because of the capacity of the aircraft coming in internationally. But overall, it's big benefits for the whole tourism industry. point in time.
How quickly will this, I guess, materialize into feet on the ground?
With numbers coming into our airport, 5 years ago, we were sitting at about 65,000 people arriving and 65,000 people departing. 2015, we hit record highs of about 82,000 arriving and 87,000 departing. I think with this extra new route, we'll be hitting the 100,000 mark in 12 months' time.
With the increase in numbers, is there the capacity accommodation-wise?
Even with this numbers growing, all the accommodation we have in Nuku'alofa and in Wavao are still sitting at an average of 35% occupancy all year round. So there's more than enough accommodation available in Tonga. Our biggest problem is excess and more people visiting our country.
You did mention the domestic routes having an improvement there, just allowing, I guess, the distribution of tourists to go internally within the kingdom. Is there hope that that will be improved upon soon, though?
It's a major problem that government needs to seriously look into, because the domestic airline is struggling at the moment to provide the service. They're currently using two jet streams with the capacity of carrying 17 people. When you have a 312-seat capacity airplane arriving in Nuku'alofa and you have a 17-seat capacity airplane to move it, there is a lot of lost opportunity for places like Ha'apai, Ewa, Wava'o and Niue to tap into those people coming into Tonga. We need to seriously look how we can better improve our domestic airline.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. And if you are listening to us on the World Radio Network or on DAB in Poland, let us know with the same email address, focus@pcjmedia.com. We'll see you in 7 days' time. So long, and take care.